Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt. Sorry, just got distracted by something popping up on my screen. I'll start again. Hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we are doing a quick fire episode today. We're going to rattle through a few interesting news stories that we've spotted and think are interesting. And we want to start with what's been a lot of conversation debate over, which is the new anti-obesity drug, Wegovy, or semaglutide, as it's also known, which has been made available here in the UK for the first time as part of the NHS just a few months ago. You'll probably have heard of this. It became a kind of sensation in the States about maybe 9 months, a year ago. It's an injection that you can take and it kind of limits your appetite, and so is one of the first kind of a new breed of drugs that have been shown to help people lose weight. And there was such crazy demand for it in the States that it was kind of like gold dust and really hard to get hold of, and there's still the company that makes it said it's still struggling to just scale up to meet the demand, but it is now officially available on the NHS for the first time. And I guess it raises interesting questions. It's not simply a kind of medical treatment, because how we think about obesity and people being overweight is often kind of seen through the prism of it being a moral question as well as simply a medical question, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an incredibly complex medical physiological phenomenon. What has relatively recently been worked out is some of the underlying endocrine factors. So it's been known for a long time that there must be chemical signals which tell you when you just don't want to eat anymore, when you feel you're just full, and the idea of any more food is just, no, stop, I don't want any more. It's recently been worked out that something called glucagon-like peptide is a small molecule which circulates and which basically tells the brain that you don't want to eat anymore. The way that these new drugs then work is that they effectively go on the same receptors, and so they're telling the brain that you don't want to eat, that you've had enough, that you feel full, and it stimulated a whole lot of commercial effort by drug companies to try to find ways of using this new endocrine knowledge. So I think it's potentially a very powerful medication, but we've got to sort of step back a bit and say, why are we seeing this extraordinary obesity epidemic? The statistics are very, very striking. You know, the rates of obesity have been rocketing up over a relatively short time. I mean, we're only talking 20, 30 years, really, where rates of obesity have absolutely rocketed. And, of course, that's the problem with the self-control hypothesis, isn't it? Are we really suggesting that, you know, up until 30 years ago, the human race had fantastic self-control when it came to food, and then we just completely lost it, and now, you know, the human race has fallen off some kind of moral landslide. You know,
yeah,
it really doesn't make sense.
It doesn't.
So go on.
I was going to say, you know, there's kind of almost two stories people tell about this. And there's the one story, which is, you know, there's no secret here. We know exactly why people get obese. It's because they eat too many calories and they don't do enough exercise. And therefore, like, there's no trick. It's just, you know, there's no magic bullet. It's not a condition to be treated. It's just, you know, if you stick to good advice on diet and exercise, you will lose weight. But then you say the other side of the story is, well, hang on. If it's that straightforward, why are larger and larger numbers of people all of a sudden finding it impossible while other people don't have any trouble staying thin and have never, despite, you know, eating a visibly unhealthy diet and not doing any exercise, have always been effortlessly skinny? And it kind of, and that's the what I think a lot of people who have struggled with obesity feel in their bones, but haven't necessarily had the evidence to prove, is that it's harder for me than it is for some other people. And yet they're constantly, the message that shoved down their throat is, well, you are a moral failure because you haven't been able to do what all of us are doing without too much trouble. And so some, I've read some interesting people saying, look, this is a good news. This is an unalloyed good news story. Some people, for whatever reason, find it really hard to maintain their weight, a healthy weight. This is a drug with not very many side effects. Why on earth wouldn't we use it to help people get back to a healthy thing? It's only our kind of Puritan idea that, like, nothing good for you can come without consequence, you know, that makes us shy away from this. Do you think that's a fair analysis?
Well, you can see the attraction of it, and in a way it fits totally with the kind of technological fix mentality, doesn't it? You know, whatever the problem is, there's a technological fix. And so we just need to work out what the mechanisms are, find a medication or a surgical treatment or whatever it is, and then apply the fix, and then everyone's happy. And it's, you know, and it fits very neatly into that zeitgeist. Like, you know, this is the idea of the techno masters. But I think you've got to stand back and ask some deeper questions before. I mean, undoubtedly there is a genetic component, and I think the genetics of this has been worked out to some extent. And again, it's all to do with where your receptors are set and the point at which you decide that you feel full. And the people who are always skinny are the people who find that their receptors, you know, they feel full quite early on. They just don't, the idea of carrying on eating is disgusting. They just can't face it. So they just stop. Whereas the people who tend to put on weight are the people who feel, yeah, I could always have another one, another potato, I don't feel really full. Interestingly,
guilty,
of course.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, me. Interestingly, you can see that from an evolutionary perspective, the people who always run thin are very vulnerable when starvation hits. If they're, for whatever reason, if there is a period of famine, the people who are always skinny tend to die first because they run out of calories. The people who, there's an evolutionary reason, therefore, for those who manage to store calories well and who walk around with excess calories, they cope with starvation very much better. And therefore, evolutionarily, they will tend to survive and pass on their genes to the next generation.
You know, which makes perfect sense. When you think, you know, when we're hunter-gatherers in the African savannah, you know, you're scratching out a living on some minimal calories, you know, 9 days in 10. And then suddenly someone in the tribe manages to score a woolly mammoth. and you can't store this food. It's going to rot in a few days' time, right? And so actually the sensible evolutionary thing to do is to gorge yourself on as much as you can possibly stomach before you throw up, and so that, you know, you can stretch this meal out, because you don't know how long it's going to be till you next manage to bring down a gazelle or whatever. And otherwise you're surviving on roots and grubs and things. And actually, that's quite a useful mechanism, except in an era of kind of industrialized agriculture, when we have plenty, the idea that you can gorge yourself until you vomit, actually, when there is not going to be a lean time coming anytime soon, it's actually profoundly unhealthy.
That's right. And there is a narrative that people moving from a part of the planet, often the poor south, where there's been a deficiency of food supplies, and then moving to a calorie-rich society, they are the ones who are particularly at risk of developing morbid obesity, because all the thin ones died out in their previous era. The only ones who survived were the ones whose receptors were set at a level to be able to store calories. But once they then arrive in the rich north and have access to limitless calories, they find they develop significant obesity. So there is undoubtedly a genetic element, but the genetic element doesn't explain this takeoff in levels of obesity over the last 30 years. And therefore, you've got to look for some other explanation. And I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that it's to do with the food producers. Exactly, you know, what it is still some debate, but I think it's pretty clear that ultra processed modern foods,
high sugar, high salt, high fat,
but they've often got lots of additives as well, which are all designed to overcome the resistance to eating. It's basically addictive. It makes food so attractive and so addictive that you just want to, it overwhelms the mechanisms to say stop, enough is enough. And so this is happening wherever, because of course this is capitalism. What the food manufacturer is discovering is if you put these additives into your foods, if you make and if you promote these addictive foods, lo and behold, shareholder value rockets. We make lots of profits. Capitalism is driving food manufacturers to make their foods addictive and attractive. And then capitalism is driving the pharmaceutical companies to create highly expensive obesity drugs to overcome the effects of capitalist food manufacturers. You think, hang on a minute, isn't there a better way?
And I guess this reminds me of the discussion that is sometimes had about the comparable explosion in rates of things like depression and anxiety, and in many parts of the world, particularly in the United States, the kind of enormous rise in numbers of people who are living on antidepressants and medication. And there's the idea that on one level, you're like, well, why wouldn't we, you know, if an SSRI makes you feel happier, like, what is the downside? But then you're saying, well, hang on, if a quarter of our population needs to be medicated to be able to live in a happy way, something's gone wrong here, and maybe we need to wind the clock back and look at the root causes of that rather than just dishing out these magic technological fix. And as you say, perhaps it's the same story with food and obesity and Wegovy, is that rather than just saying, well, let's put a whole bunch of people on Wegovy, why do we wind the clock back and say, well, why are people so obese like they never have been before? And if we can address that, then we won't need to medicate people at all.
Yes, that's right. And there's also a clear association with socioeconomic deprivation, isn't there? And again, it's a paradox because, of course, if you go to many areas of the world where resources are very scarce, the poor people are thin and the wealthy people are obese because they're the only ones who can have access to serious amounts of food. And of what we're finding in the rich countries is exactly the reverse, that the areas of socioeconomic deprivation are often the areas where the obesity problem is greatest. And, you know, I see it at first hand. We live in an area of North London, and what we see is as the schools come out, and a lot of people in our area come from fairly deprived backgrounds, as the schools come out, the kids make a a dash for the chip shop. And they're all eating, you know, this ultra processed chicken wings and chips.
Mm.
And it's like they're just tapped into already the addictive, addictive mechanisms. It's big business. You know, it's expensive. You know, these are families that don't have a lot of money, and it's all going on chicken and chips.
Yeah. And I guess this taps into another broader ethical question about Wegovy and other kind of similar brand of weight loss drugs, is that, you know, in the States, there was this kind of talk about it being a kind of, you know, a social class thing, because if you were rich and fat, you'd get the drug and you'd lose weight. But if you were poor and fat, you would be told the traditional method of go on a diet and do some more exercise and you'd stay fat. And so, you know, was this the kind of the glimpse of a future society where that kind of disparity between rich and poor is even more locked in, because even those few rich people with all the benefits of their superior diet and education who do get fat, they can just wish it away with the drug. I guess the difference between the UK is that obviously the NHS is open to all. But it's interesting that they're kind of only really dipping their toe in, because the guidelines say you can only be prescribed Wegovy if you have a BMI of over 35, which is, you know, so 25 or more is overweight, 30 or more is obese. So 35 means you're quite obese. So this is only really at first going to be offered for people who are already probably getting medical assistance because they are severely obese. And it's not going to be, you know, your slightly podgy, you know, dad gone to seed.
No, thank you very much for that.
I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about you. Generic dads who may be possibly going to see in their middle age.
Yeah, he's not
a finely toned specimen like yourself, Father.
He said, desperately drawing back her damage already done, son. But just positively, what I would say, though, is that there is absolutely no doubt that obesity is creating massive health problems in the UK. Not just in the USA, and you really see it in the NHS, the number of heavily obese patients with all the many, many complications they have. And, you know, like, I happen to know about childbirth and all the issues related to that, and morbid obesity amongst pregnant women is much more common than it used to be, and it's associated with a massive increase in lots and lots of complications. So whatever the rights and wrongs of it are, I think on a sort of harm minimization approach, using these drugs and bariatric surgery, which is another of the very effective means of dealing with this, actually is good for patients, and on an economic level it actually saves money. I mean, the obesity costs the NHS so many billions of pounds a year, that spending some money on expensive drugs, if it really is going to significantly reduce rates of obesity, then ultimately this is good health.
And, you know, that case is made absolutely explicit, fascinatingly, in the press release from the government announcing that Wegovy was now available in the NHS, you know, that in the name of the Prime Minister, not the Minister of Health, the Prime Minister is taking credit for this. He says this: obesity puts huge pressure on the NHS. Using the latest drug to support people to lose weight will be a game changer by helping to tackle dangerous obesity-related health conditions such as high blood pressure, diabetes and cancer, reducing pressure on hospitals, supporting people to live healthier and longer lives, and helping to deliver on my priority to cut NHS waiting lists. So he's very directly making the case that this is not just about poor individuals who are struggling with being fat, but he's saying, as you're saying, this is actually a public health issue. And in a public health system, this is an intervention that is literally going to save us money and free up hospital beds. And that's why we should push ahead with it.
And I think that's absolutely right. But surely we must do something about the food manufacturers. At the moment, you know, the food manufacturers have enormous lobbying power.
Mm.
And the government is very loath to limit their activities, and politically it's not at all an attractive route. And yet, it makes absolutely no sense to continue to allow them to produce and market foods which are just fundamentally damaging. And therefore, ultimately, there's going to have to be regulation.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that as that unfolds. It's worth noting at the very end that the trial, which is behind all of this, found that it could help some people lose up to about 15% of their weight over 2 years. So it's not exactly kind of, you know, significant, but it's not life-changing necessarily. And there remains some early signs that people struggle to keep the weight off in the longer term. So, and this drug hasn't been around long enough to know necessarily how they will unfold over time. So I think this is a story we'll need to kind of keep an eye on over the longer term.
Yeah, actually, that's a very important point, that there have been real worries that what happens is, yes, you get this very significant weight loss over the 2 years you take it, you stop taking the drugs, and immediately your weight rockets up again. And then, so what do? Then carry on taking the drugs. And so then
which works just fine for the pharmaceutical company manufacturing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Welcome to Capon Rahal, nestled in the beautiful landscapes between England's national parks. As a Bible school, we offer short-term courses aimed at fostering your spiritual growth and living in a community. Our historic manor house has something for everyone. You can enjoy indoor and outdoor adventures, connect with students from around the world, and learn how to deepen your relationship with Jesus Christ. Search Capon Ray England for more information.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
All right, shall we move on to another one quickly? This was another story, another medical story, actually, from a month or so ago. The headline on the BBC News website is this: scientists allow forbidden 28-day embryo experiments. Many top UK scientists are calling for the current 14-day limit on embryo research to be doubled to 28 days so they can study the unexplored secrets of early human development. Lifting the ban could yield major scientific breakthroughs for infertility, miscarriage, and birth defects, and it appears there could be public support. So this is a story really about a research project that was funded by the government here in the UK, which asked people kind of ethical and philosophical questions about embryo research. We've covered in previous episodes, haven't we, about how the rules in the UK have been for about 30 years or so, that scientists are allowed to develop human embryos in the lab up to 14 days old, and then they must be destroyed, and they're not allowed to do any further research on them. And so this was some kind of research project to see, well, how do people feel about, what about if we expanded that limit? And scientists are understandably very keen on this idea.
Yeah, so it just to recap, basically, once the first IVF baby happened in the UK in the late 1970s, 1978, and at the time there was really no regulation at all about human embryos or what could be done, and the government formed a Warnock committee under Dame Warnock, and it was really a world's first attempt to regulate this new kind of technology. And it was a committee of the great and the good, and they had various philosophers, scientists, religious leaders, and so on. And Dame And Warnock said it rapidly became apparent we were never going to agree about the fundamental philosophical status of the embryo. But everybody agreed there had to be some rules. There had to be some rules. And we agreed that the rules were arbitrary, but nonetheless, they had to be there. And the committee decided that they would allow embryos to be stored in the laboratory and to develop only up to 14 days stage. And at 14 days, they put an absolute line in the sand and said it would be a serious criminal offence to keep an embryo beyond 14 days. And the 14-day limit was chosen, although it was largely arbitrary. The reason they said was that the first formation of the central nervous system happened after 14 days, and therefore we could be confident that there was nothing that could be like a nervous system or a brain that was present. And interestingly, that happened in 1984, so it's nearly 40 years.
40 years old, yeah.
And interestingly, that 14-day limit has basically been adopted across the world. The UK was the first to propose it, but everybody has basically accepted this 14-day limit and has held for 40 years. But perhaps predictably, the scientists were all saying, yes, but it's terribly interesting what happens between after 14 days. And it's a roadblock in scientific progress. And think of all the good we could do if we could keep embryos alive beyond 14 days in the lab. And so there is definitely a scientific pressure to relax the rules. But here, I think, is something quite interesting about the way that the British political and scientific political world operates. And that is that it operates largely behind closed doors. So what often seems to happen is that scientists and politicians and media people and commercial interests get together behind closed doors and have sort of off the record discussions about what they would like. And then the question is, now, how do we sell this? We all agree that having a liberal regime to allow research on embryos is good for everybody. It's good for the scientists because they get their Nobel Prizes. It's good for the commercial people because they can have wonderful new treatments as a result. It's good for UK PLC because we become a world centre for research, and therefore scientists from around the world will come here and set up labs and do stuff. So how do we sell it? Well, this is where the media people come in. So it's often broadsheet journalists and people who work for the BBC and so on who find a way of just presenting this research in a way which is not appealing. And often what they then do is they've used some kind of group of the public, haven't they?
Yeah, 70 people, kind of like a big focus group.
Yes.
And they are kind of a mixture of people, and they ask them, you know, how would you feel about various things? It's the group behind it is called the Human Developmental Biology Initiative, and they say they're not trying to lobby to remove the 14-day limit. They're trying to understand how the public would feel if the 14-day limit was removed. And do they have any concerns about the regulation of research involving human embryos?
But of course, you can imagine taking 70 people off the street and saying, now, what do you feel about embryo research? And how would you feel? So therefore, it all depends how I present
how
it to you, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
And who's going to present it to you? Well, we are the scientists. We're going to explain to you. And we're going to explain what the embryo actually is. And so forgive me if I sound slightly jaundiced, but I feel that there's often a subtle but very powerful agenda here. Because surprise, surprise, I think you'll find that the 70 people will say, well, we think there's no reason not to extend it from 14 days to 28 days. And then eventually the politicians can propose it, you know, and either a private member's bill comes in Parliament and then it's discussed. They say, well, of course, you know, we've softened the ground. And it's often also, you have it with documentaries, science documentaries, which show the wonderful things that could be done if we made the law more liberal. Often it's presented as, you know, opportunities for scientific research. So, for instance, spina bifida, the argument goes, well, this is spina bifida happens in those first few weeks. And if we were able to keep embryos alive long enough, maybe we could understand what causes spina bifida and think of all the good we could do then. So it's presented in a sort of positive way.
I mean, have you seen this quote, interestingly, in the article from Peter Ruggun, who is the scientific lead for this Human Developmental Biology Initiative? And he says, we know very little after 2 weeks. 2 to 5 weeks is a black box. But he says the IVF success rate is 1 in 4, and often it fails after the second week of development. We know very little about what contributes to that failure currently. And so the clear kind of implication is, if you let us extend the 14-day limit, we can give all those couples desperate for their own children a much more successful IVF rate. You know, it's a kind of, it's almost an exchange he's offering, isn't it, to the culture at large. You know, you want more kids through IVF, take away this pesky limit, we'll do some research, and a byproduct of that will be that your IVF will be more likely to succeed.
Yes, and of course, you know, they may be right. The question is, what are the potential challenges and problems about allowing embryos to be grown beyond this 14-day limit? And is it justified? And of course, then the question is, well, what about 28 days? Where did the 28 days come from? Is there anything magic about 28 days? What happens?
Something about the neural tube they mention that goes on to form the brain and spine. It closes at around 4 weeks.
But there are many reasons to say, well, actually, if we could go to 35 days or even 42, you know, and so it goes on. So I think I personally feel deeply concerned about this. But I can see that if you present it entirely in terms of risks and benefits, which is the classic scientific sort of utilitarian approach, let's just think about what are the risks. Okay, well, yeah, it's not very nice to be growing these little babies in test tubes, and yes, it could be abused and so on. But what are the benefits? Just think about the positive, wonderful things that scientific research might do. Then surely these benefits outweigh the unpleasantness of keeping embryos alive for longer in the laboratory. And which is why I think that's rather simplistic cost-benefit analysis is too simple. The question is, do we want to be part of a society which is growing miniature human beings?
So we can do experiments on
them. So we can do experiments and work out how to help other human beings. Is this fundamentally the kind of society we want to belong to? Or is that kind of instrumentalization? So, you know, if I was to analyze this philosophically, I would say that this is taking one human being and using it as a product, as an instrument. Means to an end. And it fundamentally, you know, in a previous episode last week, we were talking about the incarnation, the fact that God treats humanity, human flesh, as something of immense value and reverence, dignity. Does this fit with a redemptive understanding of what it means to be human?
And so from that perspective, kind of arguments about 14 versus 28 days is slightly missing the point, because philosophically, morally, there's not a huge distinction between the research that's already been going on for 40 years on 9-day-old, 12-day-old, 7-day-old embryos and the research that they want to do on 18-day-old embryos. Like, fundamentally, as you say, the question you have to ask first is, do we want to be the people who are creating tiny human beings so that we can experiment on them in the lab, and whether they're 14 days old or 30 days old or 50 days old is slightly secondary.
Yeah, but just because we're already doing that, that doesn't mean say, oh, well, it doesn't matter. You know, no. We can do whatever we like.
No.
But this would definitely be extending the way we're experimenting on small human beings. And the question is this justified? And my answer would be, there are lots of other ways of addressing issues of neural tube defects, of infertility and so on. It's not as though the only possible way we can have any scientific advance is by doing this research on early embryos. And in fact, I think arguably you could say that research on early embryos, on early human embryos, has not generated a vast amount of scientific breakthroughs. I mean, actually, it's research on mouse embryos or on rat embryos or fruit fly embryos and so on. That's where most of the breakthroughs in embryo, in understanding embryogenesis and new science has come. And there has been some advantages, some things that have come from work on human embryos, but I would argue it's not of the groundbreaking nature that would justify the ethical challenges of doing this kind of research.
And just lastly then, does your opinion extend also to another question that was asked in the same kind of consultation by the same group? They asked their 70 people off the street what they thought about developing synthetic embryos. So these are embryos that haven't been fused out of an egg and sperm and kind of traditional biological conception, but they're where scientists have learned how to take ordinary stem cells from somewhere else in the human body and kind of cultivate them and trick them into developing into an embryo. This is a very new kind of research, and the UK is, as I understand, we don't have the equivalent kind of settled regulatory framework for what to think about it, and that people are currently trying to figure out what should the laws be.
Yeah, that's right. So at the moment, the definition of an embryo is something that's created by a sperm and an egg. And as you say, it's possible to create these synthetic embryos. The commonest thing that they're doing is that they take a combination of different types of stem cells. So you take some stem cells that come from a nervous system, you take some stem cells that come from somewhere else, you put them all together, and then you sort of create something which then starts to grow. And which you can experiment on. And at the moment, it isn't covered by any kind of regulatory framework. And again, it's difficult to know what to make of all this. But I feel uneasy effectively creating something that is almost human, but isn't. I'm reminded of the theologian Oliver O'Donovan, who said, "We have replaced the old crime of killing babies with the new crime of making beings that are ambiguously human."
Hmm.
And you could argue that, tragic as it is, when we destroy a human life, an early human life, at least we know what we're destroying. But when we create this being that we really don't know what it is it human, is it semi-human, is it non-human, to be ambiguously human is something that's deeply troubling.
And is there any clear sense about what the point of this would be, or is this just curious scientists who have no kind of moral guardrails, who are just saying, well, because we can do this, I would like to do this to see what happens? Or do they have a very clear sense, I started trying to fiddling around with stem cells because I'm convinced that I could use it to do this particular research project or treat this particular condition?
Well, I think it's mainly blue skies research, but it's blue skies research in areas which are medically incredibly important. So we know that many lethal and other abnormalities of the embryo and the early fetus, they happen at this stage. They happen very early on in the first few weeks. And therefore, the more we can understand about precisely what normal development happens, how the cells talk to one another, how they grow, how it goes wrong, the more likely we are to able to understand how terrible fetal abnormalities occur, and also possibly later disease as well. So like many much basic biological research, it does have medical implications, but you can never say for certain what the consequence is going to be, how whether it's going to lead to definable medical treatments or prevention of disease. We don't know. It may not.
And just lastly, how do you defend this position that you've kind of expressed from the kind of claim that this is just kind of Christian obscurantism, that, you know, that Christians' answer is always don't, always stop, always don't look behind the curtain, always don't explore, don't push the boundary. And actually, this is a kind of anti-intellectual, anti-science approach that just says, I'd be happy in my kind of pious ignorance rather than daring to challenge and understand more about the complexities of the world.
Well, you're right. That is the criticism. And, you know, someone like me would be described as a bioconservative. I'm somebody who is wanting to conserve and preserve respect for humanity rather than really push the boat out in terms of experimenting. And some would argue that people like me are a roadblock, you know, and have constantly got in the way of
Always throwing up objections, Dan. Just let us get on with these petri dishes. There's so many interesting things we could be doing.
I know. And my answer is these things are too important to be left to the scientists. You know, there's enough evidence of, you know, the mad scientist in the lab. You know, it goes back to Frankenstein and all the rest, doesn't it? But unfortunately, history has repeatedly shown these are not just myths, that science is too important to be left to the scientists. It has to be open to a genuine democratic discussion and debate. And in the end, is what kind of society do we want to build for the future? And is it, if there are other ways of tackling with these medical problems which don't involve ethically dubious, questionable means, wouldn't it be better to spend the big money and the focus on those rather than the UK becoming the world leader in ethically dubious research at the beginning of life?
Yes, well, interesting. Let's draw to a close there. Thanks, as always, everyone for listening and kind of going on this journey. If you've spotted some interesting news stories or kind of scientific developments you'd be interested to hear us respond to, please do carry on sending those in. You can reach us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. There's obviously lots more material on medical ethics and these bioethics issues on Dad's website. Yeah, you can find that johnwyatt.com. Otherwise, we will speak to you next week. Well, in fact, actually, we're going to go off on a little bit of a break over Christmas, so we'll keep the feed ticking over with some classic episodes.
And Tim, you've got a new Substack. Tell us about it.
You're too kind. I actually did forget about that. Yes, I'm not recording this podcast. I'm a freelance religion journalist, mostly writing about church news. And I have recently started a Substack, which is basically an email, a newsletter, and a blog rolled into one. If you subscribe to that, you can receive every Tuesday morning piping fresh takes and analysis and commentary on the latest church news, interesting selection of links of things that I found, my kind of analysis as a seasoned religion correspondent about what's really going on. So if that sounds interesting to you, please do head over to TSWyatt, so TSWyatt.substack.com. So that's TSWyatt.substack.com, where you can sign up to receive my newsletter, which is called The Critical Friend. Thanks, Dad. Very generous of you to flag that one up. As I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted to promote my own work, we are actually going to be taking a bit of a break over the Christmas and New Year period, but we will keep the feed ticking over with some classic episodes from MOLAD time gone by. So look out for that.
Oh, really classics. I'm afraid that sounds a little Molad classics.
Yeah. Vintage Molad.
Vintage, yeah. Legacy, I think.
Legacy Molad, yeah. Whatever adjective of choice comes to mind. But we hope you all have a wonderful Christmas and New Year's, and we'll see you in 2024. Bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.